KZSU, Stanford University, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I welcome you today on the show. We're recording this show on May 9th, 2007, and I'm very pleased to have on my first panel discussion of the history of Hearsay Culture. I've never dared to try to have two people on in addition to me at the same time, but I'm very pleased to have on today both a return guest and a new guest, but also a husband and wife team of sorts. I'm very pleased today to have on Jennifer Granick, the executive director of the Center for Internet and Society, and as I've always had to do whenever I have colleagues on, I make the caveat that I do work there, but there's an additional caveat, which is that Jennifer's also my boss, and so I run various risks when I bring on my superiors onto the show, but I'm taking chances continually as I do that. With her is her husband, although maybe you could say his wife is here. I don't want to, you know, set any gender stereotypes here, but the other half of this husband and wife team is here. Brad Stone is a technology reporter for the New York Times in the Bay Area and also previously wrote for Newsweek magazine. Jennifer is also a journalist, writing a column for Wired magazines, and I consider myself a journalist at this point. Even though radio is very different than print journalism, it's certainly within that general realm, so I'm looking forward to having a discussion about tech journalism as well. Today we're going to have a pretty wide-ranging discussion, a little less structured than what is usual for Hearsay Culture, because there's a variety of topics that we're going to discuss today. Jennifer and Brad took a trip last summer to Japan, and during their travels in Japan put together quite a bit of very interesting and fun information regarding robotics in Japan, the design of robots and what robots mean in that culture. And while I'm not holding out Jennifer and Brad as experts in the topic, their observations, I think, are very very exciting and also insightful as to what's going on in that world. Jennifer and I, along with some of my colleagues at CIS, recently visited the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, which I highly recommend, and saw some robots there, which kind of sparked my interest in having that discussion. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. We're also going to talk a bit about technology journalism generally, and get Jennifer and Brad's perspectives on some of the challenges there, as well as some of the issues that we're facing, which is kind of how we'll wind up the show in talking about some of the recent columns that both Jennifer and Brad have written in the last month or so. So Hearsay Culture is now back after a few weeks of various breaks for various reasons in bringing on shows. So I'm excited to have Jennifer and Brad on today. Jennifer Granick, the executive director of CIS, and Brad Stone of the New York Times. We're going to take a short music break. As we do, you'll notice a theme for those of you listening live on KZSU, which is I've chosen all music from the Flaming Lips' Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, which I thought made perfect sense given the topics today. So we're going to take a short music break, and when we come back, we'll start the conversation on KZSU Stanford. If I've done my job properly, and this one's a little easier than the telephone, on the other side of the glass, Brad Stone and Jennifer Granick.
Hello.
Hi, Dave.
Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and taking the trek down to KZSU's palatial studios here on the Stanford campus. Let's I did a brief introduction, but I think it would be helpful for the listeners if each of you, and I've learned my lesson, though. I'll say, let's start with Brad this time. Brad, if you would give a little bit more of an introduction on your background and then perhaps what led you to this visit to Japan that you took.
Sure, and thanks for having us, Dave. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and ended up in New York City working for Newsweek back in the early 90s, and I think that there isn't a cubicle in the Newsweek headquarters that doesn't have my initials etched into the wall or under the desk in that building. So I did my tour of duty. I went out to Chicago and ended up in Silicon Valley in about 1998, so I got basically the rise and the fall and then the rebirth of the dot-com economy, and just had a fantastic time covering it all. And along the way, became entranced by the sort of mechanical artist subculture of San Francisco. So I spent a lot of time at robot events like the early robot wars and BattleBots and survival research labs and Robo-Olympics. And that actually led to a book that I wrote in 2001 called Gearheads, mm-hmm. Well, fast forward a couple of years later, and I heard about this great opportunity, a fellowship, a journalism fellowship that the Japan Society does every year. They send a couple of American journalists over to Japan to just immerse themselves in Japanese culture for 2 months. It's great. It's very open-ended. There are really no responsibilities, but, you know, Jennifer and I went over there for 2 months, and we, you know, I wrote for Newsweek, and she wrote for Wired News, and one of the things we did was sort of immerse ourselves in Japanese robot culture in the same way we had in San Francisco.
It sounds like it was a great opportunity.
It was a lot of fun, and then I came back to San Francisco, and an opportunity at the New York Times opened up, so I'm essentially doing what I was doing at Newsweek over at the New York Times, covering the internet and a lot of these technology changes.
And you're based in San Francisco.
Right.
Jennifer, I understand, so you joined Brad on the trip, but your interest in robotics is something that we've discussed prior to your visit to Japan. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that background and why you're so interested in it.
Right. Well, you know, for repeat customers for Hearsay Culture, they know that I'm a geek and have been a geek for a long, long time. So, you know, my interest in robots and comic books and a variety of other geeky things sort of was sparked by Brad or reinvigorated by Brad's interest in this stuff. And, you know, when he started, when he met the people who we know in San Francisco who are into robots and building them and fighting them and that sort of thing, you know, I started to kind of tag along. And after a little while, I was even more of a convert, really, I think, than anybody else was. Uh-huh. So, you know, when he got the chance to go to Japan to cover this sort of thing, but also Japanese culture and business and that sort of thing, is a great opportunity to live somewhere else for 2 months and learn about you know, a whole different set of stuff. So it's really great to go.
Now, both of you mentioned robot wars and robot fights, which I think certainly in the San Francisco Bay Area, there is some familiarity with it. But perhaps, Jennifer, if you could describe what that means, because we've discussed actually Roomba fights that have existed at you've actually witnessed. So what are we talking about when we say robot fights or robot wars?
Well, there's a lot of different kinds of robot competitions, and one of the more popular ones in the Bay Area is to have one robot actually fight another one to the death until one is disabled. And there have been a lot of robot contests sort of built around this. Bring your robot you built and fight him against somebody else and see who destroys who first. Mm-hmm. You know, whether these are staged under the overpasses, you know, under the freeways in the East Bay, or in these arenas that are set up by TV stations to film them and make them into a televised sport. You know, we've sort of seen the kind of evolution of robot combat. And there's just something, you know, sort of very satisfying about pitting one creature against another. Mm-hmm. You know, and we were in the rainforest in the Amazon. We'd see so many crazy animals, and we think, like, I wonder, you know, who's stronger, this bird or this tapir, you know? and it's that kind of thing. What's stronger, something that breathes flame or something with a giant saw on it? Is a wedge that has no weapons more powerful than something that has a giant hammer? And you get to actually see that.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, you see, yes. Get to see that play it out in all its gory and goriness. So that's one of the, you know, real excitements of the robots. And, you know, I think that one of the things about the sport is that it is something that you can kind of do at home. They have you know, robots that are tiny little ant weight bots that are really small that, you know, you can build for not that much money. And even the Roomba, which is a kind of robotic vacuum cleaner,
right?
You know, that is kind of popular. We have one. We actually, they now have one that cleans the floor with water that's called the Scuba. But you can hack it and you can change the code, the computer code in the Roomba, and make it so that you can kind of remote control it. And then you can battle it one against another Roomba. And so there's been a kind of, you know, sort of homebrew Roomba fighting ring.
I'm going to put aside there's some interesting intellectual property issues that have come up in the past with people trying to hack robots, and I'll come back to those because I want to focus more on what I think is more the technological side of this, and perhaps I'll turn to Brad. The idea of battling robots is kind of a science fiction image that we have going from Star Wars and going back to 1984. And we always have this conception of the robot as being this giant that's going to control the world and dominate human beings. And I'm curious from your perspective, and this kind of gets us into your visit to Japan, but from your perspective looking at this world, how much today do you find, just based on observation, people are viewing robots as these evil giants versus the really what is the beauty of the idea of hacking a machine that's supposed to be a vacuum cleaner to be able to remote control it? Where is that line today in your
view? Well, I think it's an idea that's still somewhat prevalent in the United States, although it's changing. I mean, we're, you know, the heyday of robot combat was really 4 or 5 years ago when I wrote Gearheads, and today the kinds of competitions we're seeing in the United States are like the Grand Challenge, where automated cars, you know, teams that build automated cars compete to perform various tasks. And the Robo Olympics, there is robot combat, robots fighting each other, but you also have, you know, really like, you know, intellect competition. So, you know, robots that climb ropes or robotic sumo. You know, interestingly, the robot combat never really took off in Japan. And when we went over there, we saw lots of other kinds of competitions like robotic sumo. You know, they never really, you know, maybe it's the sort of the cultural differences or the, you know, the entertainment, you know, precedents, but they never really got much into the idea that robots were threats. They viewed robots as friends. And mm-hmm. so, you know, a lot of the robotic research we viewed there was anthropological, you know, mm-hmm. researchers trying to build humanoid robots and create, you know, helpers for the home.
Mm-hmm. And the world that we're describing in Japan, I think to orient the listener, is a world where robotics, it seems to be, at least by my own observation, which is, means it has no scientific or empirical backing whatsoever, but the sense I get is that robotics is much more focus of the average Japanese than it is in the United States, in the sense that you see a lot, at least you tend to catch a lot of video of different robots being designed, and the idea of, as you mentioned, which I want to get into, of robots being designed to walk as opposed to roll. Where is that in terms of the, in your sense, in terms of the Japanese culture or mindset?
Right. I think that's true. I think that they get a lot more excited about robots, particularly humanoid robots. But, you know, I have to admit that I was actually kind of disappointed with the progress of robotics in Japan. I think the enthusiasm around it sort of exceeds the reality. So we went on kind of a search for the perfect robot in Japan. And, you know, I can tell you about a couple of different robots we saw. We went to the World Expo, which actually it happened the year before, but they had the robotics pavilion was still there, and we saw this robot called the Actroid. And she was sort of a mannequin, an animated mannequin sitting inside a box, and she was there as sort of an information attendant. And she could answer a few questions. She could converse in English, and she looked very pretty, and her face was animated. There was another receptionist robot named Saya, who I went to see at the Science University of Tokyo. Very similar, you know, a sort of female robot sitting at a desk who could converse on a couple of different topics. Well, you know, what's the similarity? Well, you know, at the core of robotics, obviously, is artificial intelligence, trying to make computers as smart as humans. And, you know, as we all know, that's very far away from actually happening. So what the research, you know, roboticists do in Japan is they try and constrain the area in which the robot will be tested. So you have robots doing very specific things. I mean, it's almost like their eyes exceed their appetite. They want to create human-like robots, but the only way to do it is to really constrain the problem.
Uh-huh.
and, you know, another approach is Honda's famous Asimo robot, this astronaut bipedal robot, you know, that doesn't really say anything. It's a marvelous mechanical creation. It actually is. I went to Honda's headquarters and I saw it walk around. It's a host. So it sort of wakens and it walks a carefully laid out path and it greets a visitor and then it walks them. And, you know, it does a marvelous job walking. It does look like a little boy, but, you know, you can't surprise it. You can't lead it off the beaten path. I mean, it's and
did you try to surprise it?
I was, first of all, they have like 12 people monitoring this thing, which is another factor. Like, obviously, you know, these creatures, these marvelous mechanical creations, are really nowhere near being able to play a functional role in everyday life or fulfill the Japanese dream of helping with their elderly population or coming into the home, the small constrained Japanese home, and lending a hand. You know, and yet all these are huge cultural, hits, which far exceed, I think, the exposure of robots in the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think what we have is like a real fanaticism around the idea of robotics in Japan, and yet their researchers are still struggling with the same basic AI problems as we are here in the United States.
Jennifer, is the hacker element in your observation one that you found in Japan? Did you observe that phenomena, which obviously is so prevalent here?
Well, what we saw a lot of was corporate-sponsored robots, mm-hmm. and that may have been the kind of filter we were going through and the kind of places we were going to see the robots, but we did not see...
Well, tell them about the competition we went to. Remember the we went to, do you remember we did go so we sought out not to interrupt you Jennifer we
sought well, it out is a, it is a conversation
we sought out but I think her memory is going to be better on this than I am. I mean, this was
Mind
a year ago
Dave.
We sought out, you know, basically the equivalent of all the robot competitions and great grassroots events we had been attending in San Francisco. So we went to a nearby Tokyo city whose name is now escaping
Kawasaki.
Me. Yep, Kawasaki. And we saw basically the equivalent of the Robot Wars Robo-Olympics scene in Japan.
Oh, that's right.
It was beautiful. I mean,
it was awesome.
Yeah.
But they had a very – their competitions, again, were very different than the kind that we had that we have in the Bay Area. They had these robots negotiating an extremely complicated obstacle course that required the robot to grab onto a rope and then climb across and then jump down and go through a gate and then walk along a very narrow kind of balance beam thing.
Amazing.
Which was just amazing. And then they had teams of robots playing robot soccer and everything. And these were definitely homegrown little robots dressed up to look like penguins or dolls or frogs or, you know, strange creatures like that.
Huh.
And kids, families with parents and kids together building these robots and very you know, much one of these kind of kit-based cultures. And the people there, I think, in a lot of ways were like the robot people that we often see in San Francisco, which are basically engineers and their families who, you know, become interested in this. We also have, I think, in the Bay Area, like a very strong kind of like edgy art side to our robots because of the presence of survival research laboratories and having started here in the Bay Area. But this was very much, again, one of these kind of family things, building something in their garage and bringing it out to Kawasaki for the expo. You know, if people who are listening to this are interested, we have pictures of these robots that we took on our Flickr webpage. So if you go to Flickr and look for my name, which is Ms. President, you can look and find the robot pictures. But I think one other thing I just wanted to say about sort of the usefulness of these robots is I think one of the more useful kinds of robot competitions that I've seen here in the United States is one that came from Japan, but that actually we didn't see while we were there, which is Tetsujin, which is the Steel Man, and it is like a robot exoskeleton a la Heinlein. And a human is inside a device that magnifies the human's actions. You squeeze your hand, it's a giant pincher that squeezes or something like that. And those have actually been slowly being adopted with some commercial viability, both in an industrial context and also to assist handicapped and disabled people in doing different tasks.
Right.
So we didn't, it's, as you can tell by the name, it has a Japanese origin, but there have been a lot of American innovators in that field. So I don't mean to suggest there's no crossover or anything like that. But it is true that cuddly and pretty had a lot a lot to do with the popular robots we saw in Japan.
And you know, and I think we saw that at the Computer History Museum as well, just comparing the robots that we saw there. You had and you pointed it out, the Japanese robots circa mid-1980s that appeared to have legs and feet, and the American robot of basically the same era, and the names, I don't have the names off the top of my head, but it basically looked like the R2-D2 from Star Wars. It's an interesting functional difference, and perhaps, I mean, I'll ask it as a general question to both of you, which is the design element that enters into it here. This is all just anecdata, but I mean, by observation, when you think of robots in the United States, I know that the military has worked on attempting to use robots in a battlefield scenario, but the idea of the home robot really, I mean, certainly those robots weren't big sellers. I imagine price was probably part of it. But the long and short of it is you don't hear a lot of discussion of people wanting to have robots home doing the kinds of things that you're describing in Japan. So I might ask you, in terms of the design, the people that are working on these items in Japan versus the United States, what parallels, if any, are there other than the fact that they might be technically proficient?
You know, it's a good question. I'm not sure we have the answer to it.
just based on observation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, here in the United States, I've covered iRobot for a number of years and know those folks well. You know, they're in Boston. They're all former MIT folks, and you know, they have basically the first consumer success with the Roomba and some of its spin-offs. Jennifer mentioned the mop robot, and they just unveiled a pool cleaning robot. But, you know, again, it's constraining the problem set. It's you know, the Roomba works on a flat surface without too many surprises, does one thing very well. Well, in Japan, you know, we went to a robotic fair that the University of Tokyo was handling, and we saw their prized robot, which they had demonstrated. It was this little boy. I'm looking for the name right now. Kotaro. It was this little 4-foot-tall cream-colored robot with a boy's face that, you know, blanked and his eyes followed you around. Well, that was really creepy.
Yeah.
It also didn't get out of its chair. I mean, they claimed that it could. They also showed, Jennifer, do you remember, they showed it looked sort of like a Transformer kind of science fiction robot, and I think he was vacuuming.
It was an awesome-looking machine, very Transformer, very futuristic, with like a helmet and these kind of ear wings and just this like great broad plastic chest, and they give him a broom and he would sweep stuff
right.
up.
He wasn't doing a very good job.
No, and he wasn't sweeping up very well, and then they could show him some things and he could, there were some very basic things he could recognize, like between a set of 4 or 5 things, and they also had enabled him to learn that a human was a friend, so if they saw the human, he could go friend. But, you know, every friend there's an enemy, every good there's a bad, and once you start teaching him that, who knows what's going to happen. He's going to come after you with that broom. But it was not very effective. I mean, the Roomba, which is basically a disc, it does 2 things well. It cleans the floor, it scares the cat, but it does the floor cleaning more effectively than this great prize robot. But this thing walks and it talks, you know, and they're really trying to make it accomplish something more.
I mean, I think like we have those robots here in the United States too. I mean, you always see the sort of lab robots at MIT, here at Stanford, that are humanoid robots that look great, that aren't there yet, that don't do much. And I think basically both countries, you know, have their practical robots and then their dream research robots. And we just celebrate different things. I mean, here we're commerce oriented. And so we look at the Roomba and we look at the robots that win the Grand Challenge. And we celebrate them because of their accomplishment. And in Japan, where they're maybe more future oriented and have different cultural icons like Astro Boy and everything like that, they sort of still like celebrate the ideal, even though it's not a reality. It doesn't appear to be close to it anytime soon.
Yeah, it's. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just gonna say, and maybe it's a little bit of a mistake to judge them purely in terms of effectiveness, because there are some other kinds of things that these more advanced robots are able to do. You know, I remember reading a book, and it reminds me of that researcher that we saw who was trying to build the robot who looked exactly like him.
Yeah, his name's Horishi Ishiguro from Osaka University.
Yeah, Professor Ishiguro. And he built a robot that looks exactly like him, which he calls the Geminoid. And it's like, talk about eerie, right? Yeah,
inspired by Data on Star Trek.
Really?
Yeah, totally.
Wow.
But the reason why he's working on this robot is not, I mean, a sort of a side effect is to perfect its similarity to a real human. But his real reason for working on it is to kind of try to study what it is about what humanness is. You know, humans are very good at recognizing other humans and what their facial expressions mean and having a connection that way. Mm-hmm. And he's building this thing to kind of try to figure out what's the line between imitation and humanness. Where do people sense the disconnect between this machine and what we would actually call human? And I think a lot of robotics that's trying to perfect this similarity to a human is about trying to capture some sort of essence about either a comfort or a facial expression or understanding of, you know, what gives something a kind of animated sort of spirit.
It's an interesting area, and I think after the music break, I want to explore it a little bit more, because the whole idea of the assembly line was built around robotics, of course, but these were, as Brad mentioned and Jennifer, you mentioned, these were purely functional with no other purpose, at least that anyone could see, other than eliminating the need to pay a human being or several to do the job. And, of course, the assembly line has created a wide variety of issues with regard to how far the robots can go in that world. It's an interesting parallel that I think we can discuss a little bit from a social perspective after the break. We're on KZSU Stanford Hearsay Culture with Jennifer Granick and Brad Stone. Before we return to the conversation, now's the time on Hearsay Culture where I ask you for money. And the money should be sent to KZSU, not to me. I am not soliciting my own donations. We can discuss that offline. But KZSU operates and continues to operate with the support of listeners to continue all of the talk, music, and sports and other programming at KZSU. If you're interested in learning more about making a donation, you have a couple of options. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's kzsu.stanford.edu. So we're back with Jennifer and Brad. And I guess to close off the conversation on robotics, although frankly I think we could go quite a while longer, both of your perspectives, Brad, you kind of got into a little bit on where Japan's headed in this direction. What are the major efforts that they're trying to achieve? What are they trying to do with robots? And to ask the incredibly unfair crystal ball question, if you were to guess, where would robotics in Japan be 5 years from now? And I'll open to both of you.
Well, let me just tell a story, because as I said before, Dave, I came away thinking that while there's some very important research happening, there's also a lot of hype.
Yeah.
Well, as part of our trip to Japan, we got to travel a fair amount and do speeches through the American embassy. And I went down to Fukuoka, which is a city of several million down in the south, to talk about robotics. They invited me to come speak based on my book, and we were told that Fukuoka was positioning itself as the Silicon Valley of robotics. And I try not to make this too long of a story, but apparently their bid for that was based partly on the fact that they had opened a robotics museum in the center of town, and nothing much more than that. And also, just tangentially, unbeknownst to me at the time, Newsweek International had declared Fukuoka one of the cities to watch around the country. So, and also Fukuoka was bidding for the Olympics. They lost that bid to Tokyo. But anyways, these factors converged. We got to this museum, and the mayor of the city of 4 million was there, surrounded with press at this robotics museum, ready to take pictures with me holding the Newsweek magazine that had declared Fukuoka a city to watch. And it just struck me as, you know, a sort of a press creation, the whole thing. Obviously, they were proud of their city's designation, but in making this bid to be the Silicon Valley of robotics, it didn't appear to me that there was much underlying it. So, you know, again, some important research, but, you know, the problems inherent in robotics are so challenging. I think, you know, events like the DARPA Grand Challenge, where one very kind of coherent piece of it is laid out for scientists to tackle, that's a very logical and rational way to approach it. And I see Japan as sort of going for the whole thing right at once and not taking some of the baby steps.
And DARPA, just for listeners, is the same entity that is credited with founding the underlying, you know, structure for the internet.
That's right. Yeah. And what, 2 years ago, their challenge was for unmanned vehicles to cross the desert, and the Stanford team won. And now this year, the challenge is to traverse an urban area.
Amazing. Jennifer, your perspective on...
I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, their focus, a lot of the robots that we saw was on household items and on something being a nice companion. We saw a furry seal robot that was meant to comfort the elderly. They had a Hello Kitty robot that sang songs. There's the Aiba, which is, you know, a pet, which is, you know, they had a number of Aibas in this museum, discontinued, but that's kind of the style of robot that we saw. And in this Robo Square in Fukuoka, they had like kind of a small room in the back with some kits for servo robots that some people were kind of working on. But, you know, it's not, it doesn't seem to me like that's going to be where the real imagination and initiative comes from.
Hmm. It's, I think with that answer, it kind of allows us to tangentially talk about the general issues in the brief time we have left, which only is less than 20 minutes, but to discuss really technology journalism. And both of you have extensive experience in this area, and Brad, obviously, it's your full-time job, so perhaps I'll start with you. One of the challenges that I find just doing this radio show, and this show is, you know, just about a year old, is really making these very technical ideas accessible to people that aren't familiar. And the goal of my show, and I have the luxury, because it's a radio show, to decide how the direction I want to go. I don't have the same – I have a little more flexibility, I think, in terms of how I want to write than one in print journalism, where you have a very clear goal of reporting the news. But my goal was to make this these topics accessible both to experts and the people who are on 101 and happen to listen in. And I'm curious to get your perspective on that. I mean, and you can take the robotics perhaps as an example. The challenge of being a technology reporter in an area that while is increasingly more understood, is still a mystery to a wide swath of people, and indeed probably a lot of people even in the Bay Area. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that challenge.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you've put your finger on the biggest challenge in my business. It's, you know, Silicon Valley is racing ahead of the rest of the country and the rest of the world. I mean, there was a study released earlier this week by the Pew Internet survey organization that really sort of underscored the digital divide. I mean, 50% of American households have broadband internet access, and far fewer are using the kinds of services that we here in the Silicon Valley now celebrate and take for granted. Things like Twitter, you know, MySpace, obviously is popular with the younger set. And then something else has happened with technology journalism, which is that we've had this proliferation of news sources, mainly blogs, that have really replaced the trade press to talk to the insider, you know, community. Mm. And so the challenge is for us, for mainstream journalists that want to decode all this stuff to the rest of the country and talk about why these changes are important, you know, to be on the cutting edge and to keep up with all the changes and to compete with this new trade press for, you know, for news and you know, to sort of analyze these changes, but also, you know, reaching back, looking back and making sure, you know, we bring everyone else along. And you know, it's a real challenge at the New York Times. You know, my mom regularly tells me that she stops reading my articles halfway through. It's pretty brutal. But
well, she made it halfway, though. So that's,
I know. Yeah. But it's something that I try to remember. At the same time, you know, I do, as, just like you said, I want to write for the people who are on 101. So, yeah. And you know what? It feels to me, actually, that it's almost increasingly impossible these days to do it.
So it's actually more difficult, do you think, at this point from where we're headed?
Definitely. And, yeah. And you know, it's maybe the advantage of writing for the newspaper, but also having a blog where, and our paper is sort of getting going on that. So maybe you can talk to both communities. You know, my mom may not check out the blog every day, but you have a news source that insiders can repeatedly check. But then you also write the longer stories, well, hopefully not too long, but the more in-depth stories that try to decode all the jargon.
Jennifer, as a columnist for Wired, it's again a little bit different than being a daily reporter. My sister was a reporter for various newspapers, CQ and US News and paper in Fredericksburg, Virginia. I'm familiar with those deadlines. As a weekly writer for Wired, which obviously is one of the major news sources for technology, it's a little different. But I'm curious, when you pick your topics, do these factors play into what you write about?
Well, my column is more of an opinion column, mm-hmm. So I have a lot of more liberality in the things I choose to say and what I decide to talk about than a news reporter who's trying to give people relevant news does. But you still want people to, you know, read it and understand it and for it to have some relevance to their lives. lives. And, you know, I think we tend to have a bit of tunnel vision living here in Silicon Valley and being internet nerds like we are, and kind of, you know, getting all wrapped up in what's the next big thing that's going to change the world and is totally new, Web 2.0, RSS enabled, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And, you know, nobody cares and nobody knows, and you don't know what it is. So you're always really trying to be careful about, I think, that balance between having drank the Kool-Aid, whether it's this is the next greatest thing since sliced bread, or this is going to ruin society as we know it and we should be terrified of it, and also still reporting on what's new or talking about something that's new and bringing that to, you know, bringing that to people's attention.
It's it reminds me of an anecdote that someone mentioned to me, who remained nameless, but who moved to the Bay Area from an area of the country not particularly known for technology. And what this individual told me was the biggest difference that this person noticed immediately was if there was anything involving technology that made the front page of that local paper, it was a pedophile found on the internet or, you know, scams and things like that. Whereas obviously if you read any local paper discussing technology, it's quite different. And this person, being a technologist, was very excited at that prospect. And I'm curious, because the internet changes the dynamic, and all, you know, all of us are involved in either blogging or, you know, directly having articles posted on the internet. Does writing news stories or columns for an audience which is not just print based change the way you think about how you approach it, to both of you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, 5 years ago at the New York Times, they were, you know, probably covering every earnings report and every, you know, every I don't know, you know, completion of an acquisition. Well, in today, we still do some of that, of course, but in today's environment, you are sort of assuming that a lot of the people who care about it already know. You know, they're following, you know, the insider-y blogs. You know, they're getting that news right when it crosses the wire, you know, the earnings of a company like Google. So does it really make any sense to give that to them the next day? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we do still do some of that, but we constantly reevaluate it because, you know, most of our readers are tech savvy, and most of them, you know, are you know, readers of the business section of the New York Times have CNBC on in the office, and so you need to think a little bit harder about what constitutes news in an always connected age.
Hmm. And is it? And I guess the technology part of it, Jennifer, if you want to approach this, the technology aspects of how we do our reporting, because, you know, if you read, you know, Talese's books, or, you know, you read All the President's Men or see the movie, obviously, you know, you had reporters who were dealing with typewriters and who didn't have immediate access to information. And I think there's an expectation, at least again based on observation, that you can get any information you need in any moment and it's going to be accurate, which of course I find is not the case. Jennifer, do you find that, because of your particular focus being on the criminal law side, which has a different, I mean, it's probably a different type of audience that you're approaching there, because you'll have people that are not necessarily technologists but interested in the criminal law aspects. How does this factor into your writing?
Well, I find it sort of, as a reader, really, you can kind of see this problem of kind of self-reinforcing theories or facts that are, you know, start out and then kind of are repeated and spread around. And that's always been a problem in any kind of reporting or news media, but sort of exacerbated by just the sheer number of facts that are out there and how easy they are to get. But those stories, I think Brad's point is a really good one, which is, you know, here's what happened is kind of the low-hanging fruit now, because people are covering that. And the real challenge and the real value that the news media brings for us is this, you know, more in-depth look and kind of being able to step back from the constant flood of data and actually make it into something intelligent and informative.
The we mentioned blogging, and I think it's definitely worth discussing as well, because both of you are active bloggers, and perhaps I think more so than I am. But the blog itself also has been, at least, I mean, there isn't much of a history of blogs, but it's still a large question as to whether it counts as journalism. And, you know, Dan Gilmore and others have written extensively, of course, about the idea of citizen journalism being as legitimate, quote unquote, as traditional journalism. Now, as we see the New York Times as a great example, blogging and using blogs to augment the traditional story writing, how does that impact the news making? You mentioned, Brad, and perhaps I'll turn to you, the idea of the blog being an addendum, if you will, to the story. And I take that to mean, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you can get into some of the nitty gritty that you wouldn't otherwise get into in the articles. Or is the blog being conceived, I don't know if you can talk about it, but is the blog being conceived at the Times as something different than that? Where is it headed?
Well, here's how I think about it. I think, you know, there are great newspapers in this country, and then there are, you know, free ad-choked newspapers that have no editorial content. You know, it's a medium, and it is what you make of it. You know, with blogs, there are recreational bloggers that every few days throw a picture of their dog on the web, and then there are some great bloggers who are doing great journalism.
There are some people that do that, yeah.
So it's just a medium, and you make, you know, you can make of it what you will. And the advantages of it is that it's instantaneous. You can get news and opinion right out in front of your readers. You know, it tends to favor shorter entries, because it's hard to read on a computer screen these days. But obviously it's a great way with the sort of decline of newspapers and the reluctance of people to take that big chunk of their day to get newspapers. It's a great way to find an audience, to find a devoted audience and an educated and smart audience that's also willing to engage in some interaction with you to put their comments right next to your own. And you create a great virtuous cycle, because as a journalist, it's a way to get stories coming back into you and to engage with people who are educated and probably know some stuff. So, right. You know, that's how we're thinking about it as a complement, and, you know, a way to maybe share a canvas with some of our fellow correspondents. I mean, it's a big responsibility, and we're already all very busy.
Right.
But, you know, what we're thinking of is kind of like teaming up and doing a sort of group effort and using it as an outlet to break stories that we don't necessarily want to wait for the next day's paper to put out there, and to maybe offer a little bit of additional analysis and then just engage our readers.
Jennifer, your blog, The Shout, does a lot of the wide variety of coverage. I enjoy reading it, and in fact, sometimes I've learned about what's going on generally by going directly to it. In fact, the article that I had published in Florida Law Review came off really reading your blog about your involvement with the Michael Lynn situation. How do you see the blog augmenting the writing that you do for Wired, if at all?
Well, you know, my blog, I feel like, is a place I can kind of collect all of the links of the stuff that I've written, and then also, you know, kind of rant about other stuff that bothers me or other things that come to mind. And I update it sort of infrequently, sometimes more than others, but it's a good way for me to keep in touch with my family when I travel, and a good way for me to say when something political is bothering me. And so my blog, I think it, for me, in many ways, is far more personal than it is professional. And I think, between that and how infrequently I update it, I'm probably more typical than some other blogs. But they really do serve a wide variety of purposes. You know, as for the New York Times, it allows you to have, you know, maybe more in-depth on a story than would be appropriate for the print, or maybe more photos or something like that. For, you know, kind of the world at large, we have people who are not associated with giant media conglomerates who are able to report outside of the traditional news structure. And we know that bloggers are journalists because we've already had, you know, countless instances of bloggers coming out with great stories that are really important, breaking news. And it can also be a way to deliver niche information that's interesting to people, whether it's about a particular illness that you might have, or it's about how cute cats are, mm-hmm. or it's about the law. I mean, you know, when you are a specialist in any area, and, you know, for, you know, you and I, it's the
mm-hmm.
law,
right.
You know that you can't get the same kind of information or coverage about legal issues in any kind of general interest newspaper, no matter how good it is, that you can in a newspaper that's focused on legal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, multiply that by blogs. So there's great legal blogs out there written by law professors that, you know, I read that are really useful for my profession.
Right.
Same thing in computer security. I follow computer security. There's blogs out there that cover it very well, far more detail than any normal person would even want to know.
Right.
And that's a great format for mm-hmm. that type of information to come out. So it really is just a huge asset to our media universe, but it poses a real challenge traditional media, which I'm a big fan of.
It definitely feels that way. I mean, to the extent that I do blogging, I've blogged on issues that my goal really is more to point people to information that I don't think is getting a lot of coverage. You know, the interesting story or angle. And I'm not attempting with my blog to do my own, you know, fresh journalism, but more to point to the good work of others. And I think it runs at wide range, but it's an interesting topic that unfortunately we can't get into more detail about, because I think the fact that entities like Wired and the New York Times that were traditional print media are starting to change their view of blogs from a threat or just not legitimate to an actual means of augmenting and adding to the reporting, I think is an interesting phenomena, but we'll have to leave that for another day. In the last few minutes that we have, I think probably the best thing to do is to ask you really what are the couple of major areas that you're looking at right now? In other words, what are the stories that you're thinking that you're covering or you're thinking about covering now? Again, I say that with the preface, of course, to the extent that it can be discussed. But if you were to identify the issue right now that you think is going to warrant a lot of your time, what would it be?
Well, that's a tough one, Dave, because it's, you know, we try to keep these things fairly close to our vest, but, you know, let me point to a couple.
In the broadest strokes.
I'll point to a couple of things that I've done recently that I think, you know, I see as being sort of first steps on a longer path. Right. In the Sunday Times, 2 weekends ago, I wrote about this San Jose or actually Santa Clara, very secretive startup called Vudu, V-U-D-U, and it's a whole bunch of former TiVo people, and they're sort of trying to recreate the TiVo with an internet pipe into the back of the set-top box. You connect to your TV, and they've got all the studios signed up. It's going to be this vast movie store connected right to your television. So, you know, no Netflix required, no Blockbuster required. Well, it's a fascinating company. It has a lot of challenges. But what it does is reflect this, you know, surge of internet programming, video and music. You know, it's gone to our PC, and now we're taking the extra step and seeing it go to where we usually consume this kind of entertainment, to the TV. And I think, you know, Apple TV is the first step also. And I just imagine covering a lot of these kinds of devices. You know, maybe TVs themselves in the next year that have that internet port. So, you know, what are the advantages? Well, you know, it's the old model is sort of programming when it's on. You know, TiVo let us take the extra step, but with internet programming, the possibility is for immense choice on demand, instantaneously. And, you know, you can just see that completely changing the way we consume entertainment. It's a really powerful idea, and there are a lot of people working on it.
Well, yeah, I certainly try to make it explicit. I wasn't asking for the revelation of future stories. I recognize that. Again, the benefit of Hearsay Culture is I can just come right out there and say, here's what I'm going to be talking about 6 months from now. But I appreciate that because I've read a few of those stories, and it's an interesting dynamic, which, again, unfortunately, can't into much detail on. So I guess at the risk of running the same caveat, Jennifer, what have you been looking at now, and what do you see yourself focusing on?
I'm just going to wait until people start hacking the Vudu box and getting arrested, and then I'll be around waiting for the phone call.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with benefiting both directions that way.
Well, I have a column in Wired News today about the media, online media, and how it's affected by internet advertising.
And that's May 9th.
Privacy worries. That's today, May 9th. Uh-huh. So people can look that up. It sort of touches on some of the issues we discussed today and on privacy, which is a big interest of mine.
Terrific. In closing, first of all, of course, I want to thank you again for being here. I really am honored, not just because I work for Jennifer, but I really am honored to have both of you come down here to discuss these issues. And, you know, Brad particularly, I hope that we can continue the conversation in the future as I head to the East Coast and take a look at this from the perspective of being closer to the research triangle in North Carolina. For those who are interested in learning more about the topics today, Jennifer mentioned your Flickr page, but perhaps I'll ask both of you, since you both have blogs, your web address and any other resources or information you think the listeners might be interested in. on.
Sure. Well, my real blog, of course, is my stories on nytimes.com.
Right.
I do have this sort of I have brad-stone.com, which I have to admit was sort of an effort to push me up in the Google rankings because there's a porn star named Brad Stone.
There you go.
No joke. So,
did that work for you?
I am number one, but number two is some things we can't talk about, unfortunately. But I just linked all my stories at brad-stone.com. And I will mention this great website, robot-dreams.com. We met this American expat in Japan named Lem Fugit, and he is sort of the chronicler of all things robotics in Japan. He participates in this underground robot competition scene there. He knows about all the research robots, and it's just a great resource, and he's a great guy.
Robot-dreams.com. Terrific. Jennifer.
Well, there's a great robot competition in the Bay Area, which is Robo Games, and they have a competition coming up in June. So for people who are interested in that, they can check out that website. And that's a great resource, and as well as Brad's book, Gearheads,
right,
which they can find either from Brad's website or on Amazon.
Terrific. And I think, you know, I think for the focus on robotics, perhaps sometime maybe in the fall or late in the year, to continue the conversation with a focus more on the writing and, in fact, in where it's headed. Because as you mentioned, there's an interesting dynamic there as to what the ultimate focus will be. Well, Jennifer, Brad, thank you again for being on the show today and taking the time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Dave.
Take care. I want to thank Jennifer Granick and Brad Stone for being on the show today and discussing these issues. Robotics to technology journalism. As always, I just simply run out of time with topics that I'd like to discuss, but I am very pleased to have had them on today on Hearsay Culture. This show is being recorded May 9th and will air on May 23rd. Coming up on May 30th is Professor Michael Shanks of the Metamedia Lab here at Stanford to discuss their interesting work, which focuses on architecture and virtual worlds and technology. It's a really fascinating area, and I'm looking forward to talking with Professor Shanks. And then there will be a run of shows through June and July and into August that I'm actually recording over the next couple of weeks, as I will be in the process of moving from the Bay Area to Charlotte, North Carolina, as I will be a professor of law at the new Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. So I'm going to be working heavily to have current and lively discussions for you that will be aired on a weekly basis on KZSU. As always, you can hear the show on KZSU Live at kzsu.stanford.edu, and the particular webpage is kzsulive.stanford.edu. And additionally, Hearsay Culture will continue to air on KZSU after I've moved to Charlotte, so you'll continue to find it here, as well as on the CIS webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu and at hearsayculture.com. So thank you again for listening today. Please stay tuned for Benji and Trip Over Zero. And I look forward to speaking to you next week.